It is by now a well-known story among us. You'll recall that in July of this past year, the National Broadcasting Company sent to Cleveland a filming crew. Its purpose was to provide the 5 minutes of film for an insert into the evening news, which would be titled A House Divided. It was the theory of the NBC that, to quote its reporter here, the war in Lebanon had split the American Jewish community as no other issue had before. And they were interested in detailing that split and asking the further question whether or not the kind of unified support which the American Jewish community had rendered and tendered to Israel since the establishment of the state was in fact endangered. Would the nature of that support change? Would many within the community distance themselves from Israel? Now, the immediate cause of the selection of Cleveland, apparently, was the fact that someone had called the attention of an executive at NBC to an op-ed piece which had been written in the Cleveland Jewish News by a local attorney, in which he had questioned the necessity of the invasion of Lebanon and the propriety, the justice of the settlement policies of the Begin government in the West Bank. But the real cause was the conviction at NBC, and I suspect it was shared by the other major networks, that this split was real, that it reflected a basic change in the conduct of the American Jewish community, and that it was would be wise and proper to deal with this, to raise it up, and to try to understand its long-term implications. And the NBC activity in Cleveland did little to reassure many of us whose faith in the news collecting, news distributing functions of the networks had been shaken by the way in which they had rather hysterically reported the early events of the Lebanese war, the inflated casualty figures. You remembered one time they reported that more people had been made homeless in southern Lebanon than all who lived in that part of the country. What NBC did gave us little confidence in the integrity of the network in the sense that it went out to find what it would find and then would report it. It seemed to have come here with a preconceived notion and to be determined to find what it was seeking, though it could not be substantiated on the basis of local events. What, in fact, the NBC people found in Cleveland was a meeting of some 20 or 30 people in a synagogue, a group which called itself the New Jewish Agenda, a group who were convinced that the war in Lebanon, the invasion, had been a tragic mistake, that the Jewish state, insofar as it was a Jewish state, must always act by pristine principle, that it could respond and should respond militarily only when there was a direct attack upon the heartland, the homeland, and then its response should only be commensurate with the threat under which it was put or placed. And furthermore, that the settlement policy of the Begin government and of the labor government before it was ill-conceived and unjust, that even though Israel had become the occupying power in the West Bank because the Jordanians had attacked Israel, despite Israel's attempt to keep them out of the 1967 war, that in effect Israel must keep the West Bank in a kind of sacred trust for the Palestinians, ultimately for Palestinian autonomy, if not statehood. Now, I respect deeply the moral sensitivity which lead people to this set of propositions and convictions, though I dismiss their conclusions as rather romantic and innocent. Seems to me that they might be appropriate in another world, but in the convulsed world of the Middle East, where there is no there are no real relationships between countries except those of which are private and those which are enforced by power, in a world which is going through all the tortures of the damned as it tries to emerge from medievalism into modernity, at the very best, one can have certain kinds of makeshift relationships between the so-called countries. Most of them are really not that. And beyond that, only power, in a sense, protects for the moment. Only power, and to a certain degree, land, protects for a moment the ability of Israel to survive. But regardless of the my convictions or those of the new agenda, it is simply not true that the American Jewish community was fundamentally changed in the nature of its relationship to Israel from what had existed before. At the same time that this meeting of the new agenda was taking place in a synagogue, in another synagogue in this town, a somewhat larger committee of several, meeting of several hundreds was taking place as we made our pledges to the partnership campaign. Now, one of the things that's true about our community is that we have been so enhanced, our status has been so improved by all that America represents and all the modernity represents in America, that many of us have come to the convictions that all problems have solutions, all quarrels can be resolved, that if only people will meet into dialogue, they can be reconciled, that there is nothing out there which cannot be resolved by some kind of understanding. And furthermore, we've come to the conviction that we as Jews must take the leadership in this role and that we must see, because we are Jews, that absolute justice is always the standard by which the Jewish community or a Jewish state organizes its policies. Now, absolute justice ought to be the goal by which we and the Jewish community of which we're a part and the Jewish state to which we feel close organizes its policies, but a goal is not an absolute standard. There are always circumstances. There are always extenuating concerns, practical concerns, prudential concerns, which must be taken into consideration. The Bible, after all, includes the mandate, righteousness, righteousness shalt thou pursue, and it also includes the mandate, al tehi tzadik harbe lama tishamem. Why, do not be righteous over much. Why should you destroy yourself? Innocents abroad are often a ready prey to the predators on the streets or the traitors who will take advantage of them. And it's true that instinctively in our private lives, we all take steps to protect our homes, to protect our cars, to protect our persons, to see to it that we do not live as if the real world was not out there. We know it is, and we know that we have to do certain things to protect our persons, our families, what is precious and important to us. To make the necessary compromises with the real world is not necessarily to sin. Indeed, those who would have us always be pristine, saintly, pure, often would sin themselves because they are putting us or a Jewish state or their families into a situation which is suicidal, which is dangerous. And by common sense as well as the Jewish tradition, one ought not unnecessarily expose those whom we love ourselves to unnecessary, unwarranted danger. Now, the NBC team went ahead And it aired one Friday night, the 5-minute segment on the House Divided. It did not see what it did not want to see. It saw only what it was prepared to see. And I began to be fascinated by the question of why the national media were so mistaken, so determined to find what was in fact not there, so prepared to hear the words of dissent, and many of us had questions, serious questions about most of the issues involved in that activity, why they did not understand that the community remained one, whole, integral. And the answer, I suspect, has something to do with a particular, very special nature of the Jewish community. It's very different than the Christian community. It's perhaps because of size, perhaps because of history. But we're a family, we're a people. In every family, children, husbands, and wives disagree with one another on any number of issues. But they agree to disagree agreeably. And they understand that ultimately each one who is an adult will make their own decisions and go their own way, but the ties of family, the ties of love, that will remain close, even though a child, an adult, goes and does something which runs counter to your best judgment, they continue to be your child, your husband, your wife, the ones whom you love, you continue to support, to encourage, and to feel close to. And this sense of amcha, the sense of mishpacha, the sense of family is truly that which binds our people together. And it is a religious tie which those outside of the household of Israel really do not comprehend. But there was something more than their misunderstanding of the nature of our community. I think as I tried to understand what the media had done, or tried to do, I think what they did was to hear words and to forget that Jews love to argue with one another. And we often dissent from one another. Two Jews, three opinions. You know the old story. And we did this summer. Some of us had felt that the Israel Defense Forces ought to have plunged on immediately into West Beirut and ended it all. Others felt that the Israel Defense Army should never have crossed the 40-kilometer line, which had been set up as the original objective of the Peace in Galilee operation. Others felt that the buildup of the arms in violation of the ceasefire treaty by the PLO and the major air support which Syria was developing together with their ground-to-air missiles was not enough of a clear and present danger to justify the invasion in the first place. Many of us were disappointed when Prime Minister Begin turned down so summarily the September 3rd peace plan, which our own president put forward. And finally, almost all of us were disturbed that for a week after the Israelis had allowed the Falange into the Palestinian encampments near West Beirut and the killings had taken place, that the Mr. Begin's government had stonewalled the cry for an investigation. There were dissents, there were quarrels, there were arguments among us. Each of us was his own general and his own prime minister and his own pundit and columnist and had his own feelings about what should or what should not have been done. But that's the way families are. We agree to disagree agreeably. Now, why were the media so determined to hear this dissent as the beginning of a major rift within the Jewish community, a major distancing between us and Israel? I think there are a number of reasons here, and I don't know that I've exhausted them. They've really not been studied. In part, I think that they were simply eager to find a local side to the news that was on every night's 7 o'clock program, to find some local color to supplement what was coming out of West Beirut and coming out of Jerusalem. And of course, we Jews are the biggest consumers of news in the United States. We read the papers, we buy the papers, we listen to the news, we argue, we complain about the news. And so, in a sense, they were playing to a ready audience. And when we asked of the media why the casualties of 1982 were given so much prominence, and the casualties of 1975 and 76 of the Lebanese Civil War had been given so little prominence, and they were much larger and greater in number, the answer in part was that we were interested. We were eager to know. They were playing to a ready audience. And not only among Jews, because one of the truths of our lives is, as you well know, that whatever Jews do is somehow a matter of fascination to the larger world, for a lot of reasons, which are only adept psychologists could really understand. And more than this, I think that news is made largely in the most impacted Jewish community in the United States, in New York City. That's where the great networks are centered. And though not many of the on-air personalities who repeat the news are Jewish, a great number of the people who are involved in the management of news gathering agencies are. And I suspect that these people wanted to find confirmation of the approach that their news media had taken to the invasion. By and large, they had reported the extravagant casualty figures. By and large, they had seen the invasion as running contrary to America's national interests. By and large, they had accepted the general position that Mr. Begin was somehow medieval, belligerent, cantankerous, a difficult person to live with, someone who should not be completely trusted. And because they still have their Jewish mothers, I think many of these people were concerned that they had somehow pulled themselves away from the family, done something which families ought not to do to one another, and they wanted reassurance that out there, their mothers really agreed with them. Out there, the Jewish community really was angry with, was opposed to, was distancing itself from. And then, of course, there are strong and powerful economic and political interests at work. There are many who would like to reduce the so-called Jewish vote to silence, who would like to be able to prove to the Congress that there's no reason to pay attention to what Jews say about Israel, because, in fact, the Jews are divided over Israel, and therefore, all the arms sales that the defense manufacturers want to make to the Arab world ought to go through without protest. Therefore, the kind of special arrangements which the banks and the oil companies want to have with countries in the Middle East in order to sell their products, to make greater profits, ought to be done. Therefore, great pressure ought to be brought in Israel, because the governments to whom these people are selling are demanding that these concessions be forced by America on Israel. A whole congeries of pressures, I think, were at work, and they led to this kind of fascination with us, the American Jew, with us, the American Jew, in our relationship with Israel. Well, the spotlight was on us this summer, and the question then is, how did we react? Was our dissent really something different in kind than the kind of occasional criticism, the kind of debate we'd often had in the past over the actions of any number of Israeli governments? Jews do not expect members of their family to be perfect. We know full well that our parents are not the saints we believed they were when we were 2 years of age. Jewish family life has always been open, argumentative. Our children are quite prepared to see the darker sides of our personalities. And so it is with the community. We criticize until our support is needed, until the family is threatened. And then that sense of unity holds true. How did we react? Are there changes? And I think if we look carefully at ourselves, we would have to admit that there have been some subtle, some basic changes in the reaction of segments of the American Jewish community vis-a-vis Israel. They were not of the kind or the degree to the degree that the media were speaking about, and they did not come about because so much because of the events of this past summer. They've been on the way for quite a number of years. Think back. Think back to the early years of Israel's statehood. Think back to the years when the Holocaust was still at the forefront of the world's conscience. Think back to those early years when the establishment of the state was done with great valor by men and women who stood up against five Arab countries determined to drive them into the sea. When to the many in America, Israel was simply the kibbutzim, a great social democratic experiment, whether it was the pioneering of the country, the reforestation of the land, the draining of the swamps, the wonderful social welfare work that was being done by people to turn refugees immediately into self-respecting citizens of a free society. And in America, the society at large was confirming all that we felt about this state. And at a deeper level, the Jew with the gun supported the idea of never again, that we had been for a long time the world's victims, but not anymore. The Holocaust was the final moment beyond which we would not simply be the world's pacifist. The world wanted to turn the other cheek, let the world begin to turn the cheek. We were not prepared any longer to do so. And during those first 10 or 15 or 20 years, we drew great emotional support from the existence of Israel. And our feelings towards Israel were confirmed by the world about us. But the world's not a simple place. And the memories of the Holocaust began to dim. It became clearer and clearer to those in government that our policy had to be more, the word became even-handed, which means simply that America had a lot of interests, commercial and national and military in the Middle East, not simply with Israel. And Israel became a more complex society. It became something more than the glorious society of social experimentation, of social democracy of the kibbutzim. It became a society which had all the economic problems of a developing nation. It became a society which had all the social problems of impacted urban areas. It became a society which suffered, endured a constant siege and warfare, and therefore developed something of a Mitzadak complex, a glorification of its ability to stand on its own and to do what needed to be done militarily. And it became a society which lost, before we did, the romantic innocence that all human problems can be resolved, all political problems can be negotiated. From 1948, Israel has been willing to negotiate, to sit down. They're still eager to sit down and to negotiate. But even Little Lebanon, they're calling Gamal today the Duke of East Beirut, because East Beirut is really the only territory that he controls, and yet he and his group refuse to, what, sit down with Israel, Israel's cabinet, Israel's representatives to negotiate political arrangements. Israel has wanted to negotiate. Israel has had 35 years of frustration with this word reconciliation. American Jews have not. America has not. And so we continue to be hopeful, optimistic, caught up in our own feelings of possibility. And Israel has increasingly come to the point of view which Mr. Begin represents. That's why he is the Prime Minister of the State of Israel. He represents their feelings. Frustration, anger, aware that you cannot count upon the goodwill of the world. We've never known what it means to be utterly alone. In 1973, when the Syrians and the Egyptians attacked, and where the Israeli forces were sent reeling back across the Sinai and across the Golan. There were 3 days where Israel appealed to Washington for military resupply, and when there was no answer, not even from the one ally who kept saying, "We will never turn our back. We are constant." Israel knows, has endured, and has no reason to have forgotten. And so the Israeli stance is much more an acceptance of the tragic in life than the American stance, or the stance of the American Jew. And where the American Jew believes instinctively that there must be a way to resolve the problems, and what I hear most often and I sense in myself, if only the Israelis will be forgiving on the West Bank, if only Begin will stop with this kind of theological language about Judah and Samaria, if only they will see that Palestinian autonomy is established, then all good things will come. Now, in the best of all possible worlds, with reasonable people who are not deeply emotionally involved in the issues, with people who are of the same class, who have the same background, perhaps that kind of reconciliation would work. But what guarantee does Israel have that in the real world, in the maelstrom of the Middle East, Palestinians would be satisfied with an autonomy on the West Bank, which would say that those Jews who lived there must remain there? Would they be satisfied with autonomy which does not give them Jerusalem as a capital? Will they be satisfied with autonomy which does not give them the right that every other country in the world has to an army? And if they have an army, will they ultimately be satisfied not to use that army to gain the objectives which have part and parcel of their teaching, their propaganda, their feelings, their deepest emotions, to regain the Holy Land? It's not only that they are taught in their schools throughout the Arab world the history of the Crusades, how it took them 100 years, but they dislodged the Crusaders from Jerusalem and Antioch. And it's not only their imams teach them that Dar al-Islam, land which has once been under Islamic domination, must never again become Dar al-Khab, land which is under the domination of outsiders. It's that they have, in fact, over time, over 40 years now and more, made the issue of the elimination of the state a matter of their deepest feelings. And it's going to take a long, long time for situation to come to the point where they can not only tacitly admit the existence of Israel, which they must do now, of course, because its army is in the field, but where they will admit in their deepest bones that they will not ultimately eliminate the state or work for its elimination. American Jews facing this change, this increasing complexity in our relationships to Israel, we're no longer getting just signals which are positive, signals which are satisfying to us. American Jews have become more quizzical, a little more uncertain of how we are to respond. And we saw this this fall for the first time becoming public, not over Lebanon, not over the West Bank so much, but over the president's peace proposals of early September. Because it was on the issue of these peace proposals that for the first time, a number of national Jewish organizations went public and in effect said, "We find much that is positive in the president's proposals, even though Jerusalem has rejected these." What were we saying? What were these national organizations saying? They were saying, in effect, we look at the problem differently. Israel looks at the possibility of guns being pointed at Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and Haifa from the West Bank and from Gaza. We look at the need to reconcile. We need to look at the larger needs of America in the Middle East. Americans have become somehow convinced that if only the Israel-Arab problems will be resolved, most of the complexities in our relationships with Arab states will be resolved. An unprovable proposition, by the way. We wanted to appear reasonable. We wanted to maintain our talking points with congressmen and senators, churchmen, and other leaders in the United States who were looking at the issue this way. Because they are still and have every reason to look at the simplicity, not at the complexity. When Begin looked at the president's peace proposals, what did he see? He saw in the first instance a peace proposal which had been crafted in Washington in part to unseat him. For the truth is that these proposals were first aired not to Mr. Begin, but to the Labor Party, to Mr. Perez, and that they were put forward in part as an attempt to embarrass the existing government of Israel. And he was angry. And I think if we reversed the situation, we would understand that anger. And he was also looking at these peace proposals in terms of the reality, the complexity of the West Bank and of Gaza. He had the problem of his troops were in the Lebanon. He had other problems at the moment. He knew that in the West Bank, given what is there, that is simply, in his view, a matter of innocence to believe that grant them autonomy and you resolve your problems. Now, I think he was strategically misguided in having dismissed these proposals as he did, because the Arabs would have done it anyway. But I think we must understand the point of view from which he was operating. But American Jews, we operate from another perspective. We were operating from all the signals, all the vibrations which were coming to us from the larger society and from those which were coming from within. We're still, by nature, optimists. This nation, despite the recession of the last 3 years, is still prosperous. We are still the most prosperous minority in the nation. We have it, to use a vernacular, good. And we believe, because we live in a country whose power is large, that all issues ought to be resolvable. And we don't look too carefully at what our relationships with, say, the Soviet Union really are like, that they're worse now, not better. That our government is bringing pressure on all countries of the world to do what? To increase their defense budgets. Why? Because they believe in Washington that peace is closer? Hardly. We have peace insofar as we have it because of power, because of deterrence. But somehow when we apply our thinking to the Middle East, we don't want to think in terms of power. We don't want to think in terms of deterrence. We want to think that justice will out. We want to think that the good will be rewarded. We want to think that reconciliation will work. It may. And then again, it might not. Now, so far, the real protest within the American Jewish community against Israel's policies has been verbal and has been limited. It's been limited almost entirely to the most politically liberal, politically sensitive in that sense, groups within our community. And this includes the community of which this congregation is a part, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. An interesting series of events took place over the last 2 or 3 months, which are worth considering because they speak of the change and the limits of the change which has occurred. The professional leadership of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, which is the body which represents all liberal reform congregations in the United States, was caught up in the feeling that somehow there must be more than the reliance on power defense, which they see the Begin government as representing. They picked up these signals from the larger society. And over the fall, they began to craft a proposal which would be submitted to the December board of the union, which would be for the first time since the Second World War, put our congregational body at odds with the Israeli government. And the proposal which was submitted and which was carefully interpreted to the group that met in Denver the first week in December by the man who is the executive head of the Union, in which he said all of the things which we would want to hear about the importance of the qualified importance of strategic relationships, the importance of seeing to the autonomy is limited to non-military matters, and so on. This is the proposal which they presented. We recognize the Jewish people's historical claims to Judea and Samaria. However, Judaism's commitment to peace as its supreme objective at times mandates that even legitimate claims be tempered to achieve reconciliation between enemies. Assuming that Israel's Arab neighbors recognize its right to exist, that Israel's assured secured borders as it reasonably determines, then as a part of direct peace negotiations, we believe it should consider appropriate territorial compromises. Accordingly, we urge the Israeli government to declare a moratorium on new settlements in Judea and Samaria. These concessions should not, however, include the creation of an independent Palestinian state west of the Jordan River, nor return to the 1967 borders. Moreover, Jerusalem must always remain united as Israel's capital. We are troubled by the concept that Israel's security can be achieved only by extending military and civilian control over more than 1 million Palestinian Arabs, and by the fact that maintaining such control indefinitely could threaten the Jewish and/or democratic nature of the state of Israel. True security for Israel and for all peoples of the region entails the evolution of mutual respect and trust among Jews, Palestinians, and the rest of the world. A limited proposal from the point of view of where we sit, a seemingly reasonable proposal. It speaks of Jerusalem as a united city. It speaks of the rectification of borders rather than the demand that the 67 borders be returned to completely. It speaks of something less than a fully independent Palestinian state. It speaks of autonomy. Interestingly, despite the care with which this proposal was choreographed, the whole speech of the executive director of the Union the evening before attempted to interpret it, it came in with all kinds of preparations. At the deliberations of the representatives of our congregations, and they were not instructed by the congregations because the congregations had not received this proposal ahead of time, there was great opposition to acceptance even of this very limited proposal. Now, the opposition is now coming not from the traditionally conservative, traditional elements in our community, but from the leaders of the liberal community. And this, despite then the whole weight of the organizational machinery, they had to completely revise this resolution, and what was finally adopted is a very wordy, very long, I'm not going to read it to you, a very long resolution, some 2 pages in length, which speaks of support, which speaks of the need to go and study the issue, rather than of specific proposals as how the issue must be handled. The issue was pulled, in a sense, off the floor and, in effect, tabled. So as of yet, even among the liberal institutions of American Jewish life, there's a very limited role accepted for public criticism of the policies of Israel, and the greater role which is, and the role which is truly accepted is that of trying to understand the political, social, economic, and so on complexities so that the media impression which is left is not the only one from which we make our policies. But enough has transpired over enough years, I think, to be clear that the relationship of American Jewry, the diaspora Jewry to Israel, will no longer be simple, no longer simply be one where we get emotional satisfaction from it. It's going to be, as all family relationships are, a complex, sometimes difficult, sometimes even tortured kind of relationship. And we're going to have to make the determination that the family ties are, in fact, those which are of special concern to us. Israel, it seems to me, is going to have to recognize that the diaspora lives in and relates to a different set of philosophic principles, of political realities than she does. And instead of simply giving us medieval terms for some of the issues, as Mr. Begin often does, he dismissed the media reporting this summer of what was happening in Lebanon as blood libel. You remember that? It's a much more complex phenomenon. Israel is going to have to learn to explain itself more intelligently. It's going to have to learn that never again approach only partially satisfies the needs of American Jews, that we want a sense of what the state is really all about. We want a sense that it's moving towards some goal, even as we accept the compromises necessary along the way. We don't expect that goal today or tomorrow, but at least we want the policies of the state somehow to refract what we hope represents the best in our traditional ethical experience. And American Jews are going to have to recognize that we used Israel for a lot of things that Israel was not intended to be used for. We used Israel for a sense of our manhood. We used Israel for a sense of our political importance. Any number of Jews love to run over to Israel to hobnob with prime ministers and cabinet members and to feel that they are, you know, among the power brokers of the world. We used Israel to satisfy some of our own social democratic visions. The kibbutz is the longest live communitarian experience in the world. And unlike some of the fly-by-night communitarian experience in the United States, it's a stable one. It represents something which was very satisfying in the Jewish experience. And we have to recognize that now that the Jewish state has not been allowed to unfold normally, naturally. She's had to face war and siege and boycott and embargo and anathema of much of the world. She's not had a chance to live the way she might have wished to be. And so we're going to have to recognize that much of what she does must necessarily take into consideration realities, tragic realities, which are not necessarily the substance of our own lives. And perhaps, just perhaps, in coming to grips with this reality, we will understand something more of the world which we too have moved into. Because I think that all of us over the last 30 years have lived a kind of glorious innocence. We lived with a sense of American power, at least until Vietnam. We lived in a sense of American prosperity. It still surprises us that there are countries in the world where the per capita income is larger than our own. We lived in a world where we felt that democracy and freedom and justice were in fact enlarging their scope rather than having their scope diminished, as is in fact the case. We lived in a world where politics seemed to be somehow to resolve by deterrence or other means the tensions between the Soviet Union and the United States, and now we find ourselves in the world where everybody seems to be at war with somebody else. We've lived relatively simplistic lives, and these lives have reinforced our own innate sense, our wish, if you will, that everything can be resolved, everything can be reconciled, and justice can triumph. We've been messianists. We've believed that truly the grand world of our dreams was just around the corner. Well, it isn't just around the corner, and it isn't even in the next state. It's many, many centuries down the road, if at all. To live with incompleteness, to live with frustration, to live in a world where tragedy as well as accomplishment are part and parcel of history, this is the lesson that Israel has had to learn, and I think that we may learn through Israel. It's certainly a lesson which we ought to take to heart. And we ought to do so early, because if we learn too late, I'm afraid that what's going to happen is that we will lose all faith in the future. We will lose all sense of the importance of moving ahead, of committing ourselves to larger issues. The person who learns late in life that the world isn't out there, isn't like his home was back when, often becomes that ultimate cynic who wants only to take care of himself, and cares not a whit about the larger world. But those who, there are many who sense the tragedy of life and say, nevertheless, nevertheless, I must persevere. Nevertheless, I must try to do what's just. Even if I can't resolve the larger problems, I can help this family, this community. I can do something, something worthwhile. Let me give you an image and close with this. One of the things we Jews like best about ourselves is that we don't hunt. We don't use guns to kill animals. Some of us do, but we have that image of ourselves. Jews don't hunt. But the cynic among the non-Jew would say to us, that's true. Jews don't hunt because we don't allow you to carry guns. And if we look back at our tradition over the Middle Ages, that's in fact the truth. We never took up the blood sports because we weren't allowed to. In the 19th century, when Jews were allowed to, some of them took up the sport. Well, now we have guns. Everybody in our world seems to have guns. Now we have guns, and sometimes we have to shoot. And whereas many of us still long for that wonderful morality of impotence, when we're always the victim and therefore always in the right, where we're always being abused and therefore always we can point our finger at those in privilege and say, you're wrong, you're sinning, that's evil. We don't use guns to kill animals. Some of us do, but we have that image of ourselves. Jews don't hunt. But the cynic among the non-Jew would say to us, that's true. Jews don't hunt because we don't allow you to carry guns. And if we look back at our tradition over the Middle Ages, that's in fact the truth. We never took up the blood sports because we weren't allowed to. In the 19th century, when Jews were allowed to, some of them took up the sport. Well, now we have guns. Everybody in our world seems to have guns. Now we have guns, and sometimes we have to shoot. And whereas many of us still long for that wonderful morality of impotence, when we're always the victim and therefore always in the right, where we're always being abused and therefore always we can point our finger at those in privilege and say, you're wrong, you're sinning, that's evil, and feel ourselves virtuous. Now we have to live with all the contradictions of some power, all the contradictions of an army, with a gun. And we have very little tradition which will help us in this respect. How to live asserting our own rights, at the same time being very careful of the rights of others. How to say, don't tramp on me, and at the same time avoid trampling unnecessarily on someone else. The two moralities within our souls, and we haven't resolved the contradiction, perhaps it's unresolvable. The old-fashioned morality, which saw us as the world's victims, in which we saw all the evils of the world and preached to the world about repentance, and because we had no power, we didn't have to deal with all of its confusions and contradictions. And the macho Jew says never again, he delights in the use of power and doesn't worry about who gets hurt and as he uses his guns. And someplace in between, we have to carve out for ourselves an obdurate morality of common sense. Morality which will take into consideration practical issues and principle. Morality which will recognize that we can't have everything we want, yet others shouldn't be allowed to walk over us without some response on our part.
It's not going to be easy to maintain family. It never is, as every one of us can testify from his own experience. The ties are there, and they're still in place, and I hope and pray that Jews in America and Jews in Israel recognize the importance of examining ties, dialogue, talking together, opening up to, recognizing that the situation has changed. And unless we find the means of relating to each other in different ways than we have before, there's great danger. What NBC looked forward for this summer may someday, in fact, become the fact. And that the split between the diaspora and Israel, which we all pray may never come, may in fact open up between us. It need not be, but it's going to take a great deal of understanding of ourselves, of Israel by Israelis, in order to avoid the problem. Amen.